Joining us now is Professor Catherine Olmsted of UC Davis. Dr. Olmsted is Assistant Professor of History at UCD and has taught numerous courses in United States history. Her first book, Challenging the Secret Government, the Post-Watergate Investigations of the CIA and FBI, is a well-regarded examination of intelligence agencies of the U.S. government. Dr. Olmsted is especially interested in espionage and the Cold War, and she's always had an interest in women's history. The two are combined in her current book, Red Spy Queen, a biography of Elizabeth Bentley. Here to discuss her very interesting biography of the woman spy Elizabeth Bentley is Dr. Catherine Olmsted. Dr. Olmsted, you have called Elizabeth Bentley probably the most important spy you've probably never heard of. Why is she important to U.S. history?
Well, she was the most important female spy in U.S. history. The reason she was important is that she managed so many other spies. She's what was called a case officer, so that she had many individuals and a couple of rings of agents who infiltrated both industries to steal industrial secrets and the U.S. government. And she traveled between Washington and New York for many years. She was a spy for 7 years, 1938 to 1945. So she controlled more than 30 Americans who were infiltrating these various agencies. She recruited them, she managed them, she gave them instructions from the Soviet Union. She told them what kind of information she was looking for. And because she was such an important cog in the whole Soviet espionage machine in America, she knew a lot of the most important spies, both the Soviets who were over here in the United States and the Americans who were working for the Soviets. So she was a very important spy. And then she was an even more important defector, because then in 1945, when she became suspicious and rightly so, that the Soviets were going to kill her, she went to the FBI, and she gave all of these names to the FBI, all of the people that she could think of that she had ever worked with or had ever heard of. And when she gave all of these names to the FBI, this is what started the whole post-World War II Red Scare in the United States.
Which certainly cast quite a shadow over America for many years.
Yes.
How is it that Bentley, someone of good New England Episcopalian Republican stock, someone who attended Vassar, America's oldest and most respected women's college, become a Soviet spy in the 1930s?
Well, a lot of Americans were becoming attracted to communism in the depths of the Great Depression, because the economy was in such dire shape. And especially where she lived in Manhattan, you could see these professionals who were out of work and trying to survive by selling apples on the street corner. And so she and hundreds of thousands of other Americans looked around in America in 1934, 1935, and said, you know, there must be something better. And they believed that they were living through a historical moment when capitalism was becoming obsolete. They thought, this is the failure of capitalism, and we are in the midst of some great transition period when we move from capitalism to communism, which will be the wave of the future. And they wanted to be a part of that wave. They thought it was inevitable, and also they thought that communism would bring more equality and justice to the United States. So she was a part of that whole movement. She also personally had a sort of extremist personality, where she was always attracted to various forms of authoritarianism, whether fascism, communism, Catholicism.
So in the early 30s, Bentley finds herself in Italy as a college student, and she immediately, I guess, gets involved with the fascists.
Right. She was an exchange student in Italy. She was a postgraduate, a student at Columbia University, and she won this fellowship to go to Italy because she was an Italian, getting her PhD in Italian literature. And so she went to Mussolini's Italy, and she always had a lot of boyfriends. And once she got to Italy, she started hanging out with some fascists and joined the local fascist group. And apparently became a fascist for several months. And then at the end of her Italian stay, she started dating her professor who was an anti-fascist. And so then she became an anti-fascist. And when she came back to the United States, she started talking to her friends in Manhattan about her anti-fascist activities in Europe and sort of reinvented herself as this lifelong anti-fascist and thus ingratiated herself into the anti-fascist and communist community in Manhattan in the mid-30s.
I enjoyed the biographical tidbits you include in your book. I guess she's hanging out in Italy dating her faculty advisor, who then decides that he's going to have his assistant step in and assist her with her master's thesis. Students, not a good idea.
Right. Well, actually, as an academic, that might be her greatest sin, as far as I'm concerned, is that, you know, I mean, for me and my fellow academics, this is one of the things that makes her most unsympathetic is not only did she break all these laws and not only was she an alcoholic and sleep with married men, but she also had somebody else write her master's thesis for her. And when she turned it in back at Columbia, when she got back to the United States, her advisor said, "This couldn't be yours. You don't speak Italian well enough to have written this," because it was, in fact, a native speaker of Italian who had written the thesis for her. And but she was able to survive that, as she was able to survive so many things, as essentially she said, "Well, prove that I didn't write it," and they couldn't. And it was just easier for them to just let it go by.
But I guess the incident continues to haunt her as she returns to Columbia and tries to obtain a loan, but is denied.
She wanted a student loan, and she was denied it because the Italian department said that she did not get a loan because she was not a student of which Columbia could be proud. And they didn't explain why. And it was probably because of the plagiarism issue. But instead, she said it was because she was an anti-fascist activist, and that the department there was dominated by fascists. So she became quite this cause celeb in the anti-fascist community in New York, which rallied around her and had this big protest about the denial of her loan for these supposedly political reasons.
Later in life, when Bentley was trying to reinvent herself, she claimed that during this era she was basically led to be a spy. But your research has uncovered to the contrary, that she actually was self-motivated.
What she told the Soviets at the time, and they would know what the truth was because they had recruited her, was that she wrote an autobiography for them, you know, just typed up a several-page statement about her life, which was typical for agents at that time to do that sort of thing. Anyway, she told the Soviets, "The way I got into spying was I heard about this job in an Italian propaganda agency in New York, and I thought, what a great opportunity to spy for the communists. And so I got the job, and then I immediately reported for duty to the Communist Party headquarters and said, I'd like to spy on the fascists for you." So she became a spy herself. And once she presented herself at the Communist Party headquarters, the Communist Party in turn told the Soviet intelligence agency, it changed names a lot, but essentially it was the KGB, told the KGB that here was this great potential recruit, because here she had all of these credentials, Vassar and the native-born Connecticut thing, and she was just about as Yankee as you could get. And so no one would suspect her of being a Soviet spy. She wasn't an immigrant. She wasn't Jewish. She didn't have a long left-wing background. And so she was turned over to the KGB as someone who they could use. So she activated herself as a spy. She wasn't suckered into it by anyone.
Bentley then gets turned over to a big-time Soviet spy who, contrary to good espionage procedures, becomes the love of her life.
They were very unprofessional in the way they handled themselves. She was turned over to this man named Jacob Golos, who was one of the most important Soviet spies in America. He was an immigrant from Russia, but had been in the United States for many years. And he handled a lot of important Soviet spies in the United States. He was one of their top case officers. So he takes her on as an agent. They fall in love. And then he starts training her to be his assistant. So they violated so many basic rules of spycraft. And Golos had always been like this. And this comes up again and again in the Soviet cables and the Soviet files, is that the KGB is so frustrated with him, as he's such an independent operator, that they can't control him, and they keep telling him to be more careful in the way he operates, but he's just basically a really sloppy guy. He carries around lists of his agents with their phone numbers in his pocket. And so he tells her the names of his agents. He and Bentley meet with his agents together. They know his real name. They know her real name. It's a very incestuous community, and it's completely contrary to what you should do if you're a real professional spy, which is to not let them know where you live or what your phone number is or your real name or who your girlfriend is. And they should not, your agents should not know each other. Because if someone is caught or someone decides to defect, then they can expose everyone. And of course, that is what happened with Bentley.
Bentley's cover as a spy is then provided by a shipping agency to which she is, in essence, the vice president. And perhaps we have to score one for the Soviets on this. She was able to obtain a position commensurate with her her ability at the shipping company, and she was not able to do so when she came across to the FBI side.
That's true. The Soviets had an interesting attitude towards women's equality, in that officially their doctrine was that women were equal to men and that they should give them the same types of opportunities. And so she was able to use that rhetoric and turn it into reality and become this shipping executive and also become an important spy for the Soviets. They didn't always practice what they preached, and a lot of her Soviet controllers, after her lover Jacob Golos died, really patronized her and didn't believe that she was up to the job because she was a woman. But while Golos was alive, she was able to attain these very important positions. And the FBI files show that she was a very engaged shipping executive. She ran this big company, and she managed lots of people. She worked many hours a day. She made a lot of money. The Soviets paid her $800 a month, which was just a huge sum in those days. So it was the kind of money that meant that you could go take vacations in the Caribbean a couple times a year and go to Turkish baths and have massages and eat out at fancy restaurants every night. And so she really enjoyed that sort of life.
So she's living the high life as an executive, running a Soviet spy ring, and passing along information, although I gather that most of it is not terribly earth-shaking.
Yeah, it's hard to say still exactly what kind of information she stole, because she was mainly, since she didn't steal the documents herself, what she would do is go down to Washington, and her agents would steal information, and they would give her the documents. Sometimes they would just give her the microfilmed version of the documents. She would put them in her knitting bag, which she thought the police would never think of searching, and take them back to New York. So to some degree, she wasn't aware of everything she was stealing, of all the information she was stealing. But she did remember some things, and sometimes she would pass on instructions, or she would debrief her agents so that she would know, so that she could later tell the FBI exactly what kind of information she was stealing. A lot of it was simply gossip. She had agents in the White House, and what the Soviets were really interested in during World War II, when they were our ally, is who is in the White House, who around Franklin Roosevelt is most favorably disposed to the Soviet Union. And so who should we approach if we need a loan, or who can we play off against each other? So a lot of that was the kind of information she was giving them. Overheard comments in the hall. The Secretary of the Treasury seems to really admire Stalin, things like that. But no, nothing really earth-shattering. She wasn't, she didn't have spies in the atomic bomb project. She was a spy in Washington and New York, not in New Mexico.
As your biography points out, as is so often the case with Elizabeth Bentley during her life, she next manages to get herself in hot water with her superiors, in this case, the KGB.
Yes, she was not the most tractable woman ever. Whether she was a student in Italy or at Columbia or a spy or a shipping executive or later when she was a double agent for the FBI, she was always very independent-minded. And after her lover died, the Soviets themselves start to control her. Actual Russians, many of whom don't speak English that well. And she has real contempt for them. that they come over here and they don't speak English and they don't dress like Americans. And a lot of them are fairly crude, ruthless people who have succeeded in the KGB. And so it gets more and more obstreperous and says, no, I'm not going to do that. They want her to start turning over her agents to them. They demand this and say Golos was sloppy. Now he's gone. We're going to reassert control. And she rebels against that and says, no, I like controlling my agents. I want to continue to control them. And they say, no, you must give them over to us. And she keeps rebelling. And after a while, she finally begins to realize that this is a very dangerous thing to do, to defy the KGB. And in fact, the Soviet documents show that they did start talking about assassinating her because she was not easy to control.
So I gather that at this moment, she decides it might be nicer to come across to the FBI side of things.
Well, and not that so much nice as essential, because she is really more and more convinced as 1945 progresses that she is in great danger. She's worried about the KGB and that they might assassinate her. She's worried also that the FBI might be on to her. Actually, FBI files show that they weren't. They had no idea who she was. And so when she first came into the office, the agent thought that she was a psychotic. She's also worried that if she doesn't turn herself in to the FBI, that the U.S. government will put her in jail or the Soviets will assassinate her. And she spends many months making this decision, getting more and more paranoid. One of the last triggering events for her defection is that she starts an affair with a man she meets in a bar who is actually a man who owns a curtain shop and has a wife and three kids. But he tells her, it's kind of his pickup line, is that he's actually a secret government agent. And so, of course, this just freaks her out. She is so terrified by this that she thinks, well, now the FBI is really on to me. And she doesn't know why they're announcing themselves to her.
Right.
But it makes her paranoia even worse. So her paranoia about the Soviets, her paranoia about the FBI all combines together. And finally, she decides, well, I just have to, make a decisive step and go into the FBI and get protection.
Turns out this guy is really full of hot air.
Yeah.
She weighs her options and decides that she'd better come across to the FBI side of things. And for their part, they've realized that she's the real deal.
The FBI believes her because the FBI uses some illegal techniques at the time, like breaking into people's houses, that they can't use in trials because they're illegal. But in their break-ins, they discover a lot of circumstantial evidence that supports her story. Most important, they break into the house of the person she said was microfilming the documents for her, and they find this dark room in the basement. And so the FBI, after a few months of following her and checking out her story, really does believe she's telling the truth. But they can't prove it, so they start just running her as a double agent to try and get more evidence.
J. Edgar Hoover was not regarded as someone capable of running double agents by Sir William Stevenson of British intelligence. Hoover, for his part, I guess, didn't trust the British. Well, ironically, thanks to Stevenson, I guess Elizabeth Bentley did not turn out to be a very successful double agent for the FBI.
Well, J. Edgar Hoover was very concerned that the Soviets would find out about Bentley's defection, which would be disastrous because then they would stop running all of their agents and then the FBI couldn't catch them in the act. So he had put out an order and said absolutely only essential personnel will know the identity of this informant. All of hundreds of agents he put on the case knew only that there was an informant named Gregory who was helping them. And they knew nothing about the informant. In fact, they thought it was a male. He only told her real name to a handful of people. And one of them was the head of the British intelligence service, Sir William Stevenson, who in turn told a man named Kim Philby, who was in charge of catching Soviet spies for the British. And he happened to be one himself. So immediately, Hoover tells Stevenson, Stevenson tells Philby, Philby tells the Soviets. And within days of her defection, the Soviets know. And so they do just what Hoover feared. They warn everyone who had any dealings with Bentley. They say, stop spying, stop talking to each other. And essentially, they shut down their whole North American espionage network.
So, thanks to Kim Philby, Elizabeth Bentley is a very unsuccessful double agent.
Yes.
So, I gather that for a couple of years, she's an unsuccessful double agent, and that she begins to long at this point to profit from the story she has to tell.
She's a double agent for a couple of years. She's not paid during those years to be a double agent. Her day job is she's a secretary. She's not able to get any executive position. She complains about this a lot. She has a lot of executive experience, but the American companies won't hire women to run companies. So she finally gets a job as a secretary, making very little money. The FBI keeps saying, you can't tell anyone what you're doing because we're still working on the case. And so after a couple of years of this, she approaches the FBI and says, can I please tell my stories to the newspapers? Because I think that then I can start making some money by selling my story. And the FBI says, under no circumstances can you do this. So instead, she starts meeting secretly with the newspaper reporters, just completely defies the FBI. And her story comes out in the summer of 1948. And J. Edgar Hoover is just furious about this and calls her behavior outrageous. But just like she defied the KGB, she defies the FBI.
You are listening to an interview with Professor Catherine Olmsted of UCD's History Department, as she describes the interesting story about Elizabeth Bentley, the Red Spy Queen. This is Radio Parallax. I am Douglas Everett. We have to take a short break, after which Dr. Olmsted will return to tell us about how Elizabeth Bentley became an important figure, a very important figure, in America's great post-World War II Red Scare.